Tynwald was packed with interesting debates and questions, and government may still be licking its wounds after some bruising encounters during the sitting. Questions pondered how people who rely on cash will cope when the MyCard system is scrapped, and whether the Manx economy is in recession. A new Child First policy was received by Tynwald, and there was unanimous support for a call to introduce a comprehensive programme of neurodiversity training in Manx schools. We'll hear first from Enterprise Minister Tim Johnston.
We probably need to start with the first or the second question, I think it was, that you had to answer, and that was from Laurie Hooper. And basically, Laurie Hooper was saying we're several years now into a recession in the Isle of Man. Is he right?
I'm not going to get drawn into, you know, Laurie Hooper's negativity about things. I mean, as I said in the court, you know, we're in a really challenging place, I think, globally at the moment. If you take that into account, the Isle of Man has steered a pretty steady course. We've got low unemployment. We have seen growth over that period. Obviously, we've also seen high levels of inflation as well. So, you know, if Mr. Hooper wants to try and pick negativities, he can do. What I have to do, my responsibility, is to look at the bigger picture and step back and say, you know, what are the challenges? What's going well? And it's interesting at the government conference having two speakers who off island or independent as such, who said that, you know, despite everything that's going on in the world at the moment, the Isle of Man's actually doing really well. And but that in no way means that we haven't got challenges. I accept that.
And I suppose, I mean, I guess it's obvious that ministers don't want to use the word recession, but when GDP has fallen, which it appears to be doing, that's not a good thing, is it?
Well, what we've seen is we have seen growth over that period. Clearly, we've also seen high levels of inflation. So, I mean, when you talk about the real term position, what we've actually seen, if you step back and look at it, it's been pretty steady and pretty stable. Has anyone up to the stage over the last few years come out and said, you know, the definition of recession and said we're in recession? No, they haven't. So, you know, I'm not going to get into that conversation. What I'm going to do is look forward, talk to business and do what we can to move things forward.
And of course you will be talking regularly to businesses, and those businesses will be saying to you that it's quite a difficult environment to be in at the moment.
It is a very difficult environment to be in at the moment for many sectors. I think some sectors it's fairly stable and steady. We're seeing that. But yeah, I mean, we're having these ongoing conversations around, you know, the hospitality sector and the retail sector. You know, we recognise those challenges, and therefore the question that you ask yourself is, well, what are government doing about it to try and help and support? And I would say, well, you know, getting our visitor numbers back up to 330,000, you know, 12 million pounds spent in the visitor economy last year, you know, record numbers get back up at the TT nearly, you know, for 50,000, over £50 million spent in the economy over that period of time. You know, what we need to do as a government is make sure that we're providing opportunity where we can, and that's what we'll keep doing. But in no way do I say that there aren't challenges. We recognise, you know, there's lots of pressure at the moment. There's lots of pressure over money value. That's creating a lot of concern. But again, we all recognise if we don't get through some of these things, it's going to be a major issue for us in the longer term. So what I say is, let's just step back sometimes, look at the bigger picture, look at things in context, look at our levels of unemployment, record lows, and actually let's not talk down our economy, because I think that's unfair.
And I suppose if Laurie Hooper was here, he would say, well, actually, all I'm doing is looking at your figures, and your figures are suggesting that you know, this is a bad situation. I mean, you've admitted it yourself that the situation is not wonderful.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because people roll out GDP and GNP, they use it when it suits them, and the rest of the time they say, well, actually, that's a very crude method of measuring anything. You need to look at much broader sectors and look at the broader economy, and that's what I'm doing, and will continue to do.
One of the big new ideas was going to be the idea of growing medicinal cannabis on the island. What's happened with that?
Yeah, and that's something that, you know, it's still moving forward, Phil. I mean, I think, as I said in my answer, it is a slow process. I mean, what our responsibility to do as government is to set out the sort of playing field and the regulation and the licensing to allow that sector to thrive. And that's what we've been doing, but it's been a really difficult process. I think it's, you know, you go back, I think it was the previous administration talked about wanting to see the sector evolve and move forward, and that's what we're looking to do. But clearly, once you start looking into it, you realise it's a real challenge, and I think, you know, other jurisdictions have found the same. So a lot of work's gone on, a lot of complex structures in place, you know, regulation through the GSC, licensing via the DHSC, and we have a memorandum of understanding with the MHRA in the UK. All these things have to be in place for us to be able to move forward. And we've still got some other regulatory challenges that we're still trying to iron out at the moment as well. So that makes it challenging. But in the meantime, in parallel to that, we have seen interest. We have seen certain businesses progress. We've seen one license being brought out, and we've seen a successful planning application. So, you know, that's really positive to see. But we always recognise that this is a very highly technical, very highly regulated sector, and it was always going to be complex.
Do you actually have enough resource in the department to do all the things that you need to do to make sure that Laurie Hooper can't point to occasional figures and say, actually, the Isle of Man's in recession? Have you got enough financial and officer resource to actually do the work that's needed to help the Manx economy grow?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think, again, we don't want to get accused again of filling, you know, too many people, too many layers into this. I mean, as a department, we know, you know, this is not done in isolation. You know, we're working very closely with Treasury and across government in these areas. And obviously, you know, the agencies have a big part to play in that as well. So, no, I think we are resourced. I mean, bottom line is, there is a challenge, and I think, you know, we have to accept that. This is not an easy time. I mean, I think, you know, we really do sometimes as an island have to just look up sometimes and look out and realise just how challenging the world is at the moment and the global economy. And taking that into account, we have steered a pretty stable course through it. And that shows in our ratings. We've seen our Moody's ratings. It's seen in our own employment levels. And, you know, we've built reserves back up to 1.97 billion. You know, we've got through COVID. We've made real progress. But nobody wanted to see the challenges that the global economy has faced over the last few years. And certainly when I came in 2021 as a fresh-faced MHK and walked straight into sort of the Ukraine-Russian war and massive increases in inflation, etc., none of us wanted to see that, but that's the reality of what we've had to face with. And, you know, as a government, we are charged with trying to find our way through that and taking as many people and taking business along on that journey. And that's a real challenge.
One of the suggestions that was made during the question time was, yes, indeed, we do have near full employment, but many of the new jobs seem to be lower paid. Is there any truth in that?
Well, I think it's an easy thing to say. I mean, I would like to see that backed up with the facts and the figures. I mean, I think, you know, clearly we have to have and do need to have a broad range of trades and qualifications on the island. And, you know, we have a large hospitality retail sector. We recognise that they tend to be more of a lower paid area, but at the same time, if people wanting to have those facilities on the island, they have to have staff to be able to man them. So we need the full range of talent and price ranges and pay ranges, sorry, across the economy.
That was Aaron Michael, MHK, Tim Johnston. So is Laurie Hooper just talking the economy down?
You had a number of interesting questions on the order paper or the question paper. The one though that I'd like to start with is in relation to the state of the Isle of Man's economy, which, according to the Enterprise Minister, you're just trying to talk it down.
I think that's always the defence when ministers don't understand what they're talking about. The government publishes some statistics called the Isle of Man in Numbers, and they show quite clearly we've had contractions in the Isle of Man economy over the last 3 years. And some of that's probably to be expected because of COVID. But actually what you've seen elsewhere is bounce backs. You haven't seen sustained year-on-year reductions. And the worry is, what the numbers seem to be showing, is we're getting prices going up, but we're not seeing the island become more productive. So the economy isn't growing, everything is just getting more expensive. And that tallies with what people are telling you on the street. It also tallies with the job numbers. There's more jobs, but actually more people are working multiple jobs, so there's more low-pay jobs out there. All this is not good news. And that's what all the data seems to be showing us. And the question I asked the minister was, have you done any analysis on this? And the answer seemed to be, I have no idea what I'm talking about. And that is a really scary position to be in when your own government, your own Minister for Enterprise, doesn't seem to have a clue about what these data is showing us.
So the minister has a point in that if Timlade focuses on the negatives, it could end up undermining confidence in the Manx economy. Well, I suppose I'll put that question to you directly. Has the minister not got a point there?
I don't think so, if I'm honest. I think what undermines confidence is when all that you get is spin from the government, when you have a government that refuses to acknowledge the genuine challenges that are out there and tries to tackle them. If everything the government tells you is, it's good news, people, it's good news, I promise. I mean, the minister kept saying it's stable, it's everything is going well. We know it isn't, and that's the problem. That's what damages confidence. You have to be able to have these open and honest conversations about what's really happening before you can start tackling the problems. And I wasn't asking the minister if he has a plan to tackle these problems, because I think that would be premature. I wasn't asking if he'd got answers to all of these questions. I was simply asking, do you understand what is going on? And the answer was no.
And you're saying it is premature to have a plan. They do have a plan. It's called the economic strategy, and surely that has to be something for Timlade members to get behind. I mean, was it approved by Timlade?
So I think that's part of the problem, is we have an economic strategy, but I don't think the government has ever truly believed in it. Lots of things in that strategy talked about broadening the tax base, for example. Lots of things in there that we should be doing that the government has made no effort to do at all, because it's all difficult and it involves shifting away from some of the more traditional approaches that we've taken on the island. And so, yes, we have an economic strategy. We're only 3 years into that. It will take time for it to bite, time for it to start actually delivering. But the government has already decided it's time for a change. You can't plan long term and have a long-term economic strategy if less than 3 years in you're going to say, actually, let's go back to the drawing board and start again. And I think that's part of the problem here, is you need a government, you need politicians that are capable of taking the long view rather than panicking every 5 minutes because something isn't quite going their way. And that's kind of what feels like is happening here, is you've got a government that doesn't really understand the data, doesn't really understand what is happening out there on the ground, and is reacting to bad PR or bad social media or whatever it may be, rather than actually governing.
But again, you would expect government to listen and to adapt to changing circumstances. And if they've decided that actually we need to alter the plan, we need to make some changes, surely that's a listening government doing the right thing by adapting to the changes as they come along.
And actually, I would agree with that. And if the minister stood up and said, yes, we've looked at this, we know there's an issue, we're aware that things aren't working as well as they should do, and that's why we're making changes, I think I'd have had quite a lot of respect for that position. That isn't what they said. What they said was, everything's fine, everything is stable, there's nothing to worry about here, you're just talking down the island, and by the way, we're changing our whole economic strategy. That doesn't make any sense. And that's the challenge I've got here, is I don't think they understand what the problem is, and yet they've already decided that the economic strategy is part of the problem. But how do they reach that conclusion? How have they decided that everything is stable, everything is fine, when it so clearly isn't?
You also mentioned about the potential that the reason we have low-level unemployment is because there's a lot more lower-paid jobs out there. I mean, do you have any evidence to back that up?
I mean, the data that's published does show that. I mean, there's more jobs now, more people in employment and more people in jobs today than there were a few years ago. But our economy is not more productive, which means those jobs that we have must be, on average, less productive than the jobs we had 5 years ago. And that's the problem. And that's what the data shows us, is we have price rises, we do have more people in employment, but our productivity hasn't gone up, which means those jobs can't be all in high-performing, high-paying sectors, they must be low-paid jobs. And there's a lot of other data that kind of backs up that kind of question. You've got tax receipts, you've got NI, there's lots of other other data points that when you put the picture together shows that what we've been growing over recent years is a low-pay economy rather than a high-pay economy. But again, you'd think the Minister and the Enterprise Department would have done some of this analysis and would have been able to say, actually, no, we've got the data on those jobs, we know where they are, we know they're high-paying, we know that you're wrong. They couldn't even say that, and that's what really worries me, is this data is being published, the government clearly has this information, but no one is looking at it.
You had a closer-to-home question in relation to Ramsay Cottage Hospital. There have been some well-publicised closures there in recent weeks. Were you satisfied with the answer that the Health Minister gave?
Not really, if I'm honest. It was always intended to be a temporary closure of the MIU while Manx Kest sorted out some recruitment, and it seems that someone somewhere has dropped the ball on making that happen, which is why the closure has been extended. I'm quite pleased to see the Minister make a commitment to reopening the MIU on weekends and bringing back some x-ray services. All that sounds really positive. But what really worried me was the way they got to this situation in the first place, because the Manx Care Act places a legal duty on the department, on the Minister, to make sure that the public are consulted and engaged when service changes are made. And this isn't about taking an afternoon off for a GP, as the Minister said. It is about when you're changing the service that we deliver, and actually making decisions around changing MIU is changing the service. The law says they have to tell people. They have to engage. They didn't do any of that. And the department really has let themselves down by not making sure they're complying with the law. I will say, though, to the Minister, you know, kudos for actually standing up and holding your hands up and saying we dropped the ball on this one. That was welcome, actually, to have a minister for, you know, it's not very often you get a minister standing up and saying, sorry, we got it wrong. So that was good to hear. But I wasn't reassured that this kind of thing isn't going to happen again. I wasn't reassured that they have a process in place to make sure that they are complying with that part of the Manx Care Act. And so that's something I think I'm going to have to follow up.
And the other question that I've highlighted anyway that you had was in relation to identity cards. I mean, the Chief Minister basically said, well, look, they haven't really said what they mean by identity cards, so it's difficult for us to know how to react.
Yeah, and to be fair, I don't think that's an unreasonable response. I would just like our government to be a bit more proactive. If I was the Chief Minister, for example, when that announcement had been made, I would have immediately got my external relations team to write to the UK Cabinet Office and say, hi guys, just heard about your proposal for digital ID. Don't forget, you've got lots of British citizens living on the Isle of Man, so can you make sure you don't forget about us, please? I would have been more proactive, and that's kind of what I was hoping he would say, that we don't know the details yet, but we have been in touch with the UK. We've put us on their radar to make sure that we're not left out in the cold on this. That isn't what he said. He seemed to be saying, actually, we'll wait and see what they publish before we engage. So, like I say, I'm not expecting the earth to move on this one. I'm expecting the government to engage, and the Chief Minister did say they will be engaging. I was just a bit surprised that we weren't a bit more on the front foot.
That was Ramsay MHK Laurie Hooper. John Wannenberg had a few questions. I asked him first about his MyCard question.
It would appear that there are just 1,000 people left on MyCard. Perhaps that's because those people actually really value being able to go to the post office and get cash.
Well, I suppose you could say that that's accurate for some of those 1,088 people, yes. I think the Treasury Minister mentioned that some people are possibly waiting until the end of the year before they switch over from MyCard to their already established bank accounts. But my question in main was to ask what provision had been made for those people who do not have a bank account, either by choice or not by choice. And that includes those people who come through the criminal justice system. At least we can provide them with, you know, the means to source the money. We are going to create a problem, I think, for ourselves. And we have an existing template which works with the MyCard. I understand it costs a lot of money to run. I understand the Treasury Minister wanting to reduce costs wherever he can. But the onus is on him to provide an as good solution, if not better solution. And at the moment, we don't have it. And we're 71 days away from closing it down. So that's why I asked the question.
Were you surprised that the Treasury Minister didn't have any figure on how many people who use MyCard actually don't have a bank account?
Am I surprised? No, I don't think I am surprised. Is it crucial? No, I don't think it is. His department has to provide a means for those people to fund their lifestyle, to access their benefits or whatever the case is. It has to be done in such a way which they are not discriminated against just because they do not have a bank account. We have that now. So if it's going to be replaced, then it must be better than what we have.
And of course, there are people who have bank accounts whose banks have closed their branches in the areas in which they live. And particularly when we're talking about older people, yeah. They still like to use cash as far as possible. It becomes, I guess, much more difficult for them to do that when there is when the MyCard is removed.
Well, exactly, and it is a lot of old people, but not predominantly, not exclusively them. But I can visualize the face of several of my constituents who are in exactly that boat. And I have told them that I will follow this up, and I have lobbied the Treasury Minister both on the floor, like I did today, and I do it privately as well. And I need to get an answer for them as soon as possible.
And you seem to have taken the approach when it comes to Timlt questions that if the hard work behind the scenes isn't paying the dividends, then maybe it's time to put the question down on the Timlt order paper.
Yeah. I'm not a politician who would ask questions for the sake of asking questions. I'll leave you to interpret that the way you want. But if I feel that I'm getting no joy elsewhere, and I do prefer a written question, I think I get much more detail, then I'll ask on the floor, and I will lobby in any way I can to get the answers I need.
The other questions, we'll move on to the one that you asked about Cube International, and you were interested to know about the outstanding debt. Well, to begin with, for those who don't know, what was Cube International?
So Cube International, they were the company, or one of their subsidiaries, was the company that provided TT merchandise. And I think they were a new supplier, and they came in... they subsequently went bankrupt, and they owe, I believe, in the order of well over £100,000 to the Isle of Man government, and also to certain smaller businesses on the Isle of Man. And I believe the process of liquidation is underway. So I wanted to know from the Enterprise Minister as to what we are doing to recover that money. At the end of the day, that is taxpayers' money, and we can't just simply. And lessons will be learned, because lessons clearly are not learned. Money talks, and we want the money back.
And of course, at the time that they took over the contract to sell TT merchandise, there was some concern that an off-island company was being favoured over Manx firms.
Yes, that is correct. And you know, there are times when off-island companies are better, provide a wider... supply of goods, but up until that point, I think local companies had done a very good job. So there are questions as to why Cube was appointed in the first place. There may well be a good reason, there may not be. But either way, they owe the Isle of Man government a substantial amount of money, and we want it back. Simple.
And then your final question was in relation to the Liverpool ferry terminal. You're looking for answers from the Treasury Minister, the DOI Minister, in relation to what the final cost of that was. It's fair to say that the answer is the final cost is still to be determined, and there are ongoing disputes.
That is correct. I mean, when Tim Crookle was the DOI Minister, I put a question to him exactly what I've put to Michelle Hayward today, and we would like to know the final cost of the ferry terminal. He then gave me an answer to say, well, we'll tell you in a year's time. So that day I then put a question in for a year's time, which was the closest amount, day where I could ask it as to what it was. And it would appear that... they cannot quite answer that just yet, because there are some areas that are yet to be resolved with contractors. And I don't think they can tell me too much until it has been resolved. So I did ask the minister if she could give me an assurance that she is doing her utmost to make sure that whatever cost is outstanding has been paid, she and her department are doing their best to minimise that cost. She gave me that assurance, so time will tell.
That was Douglas North, MHK, John Wannenberg. Next, Treasury Minister Alex Allenson.
It is fair to say that you got quite a bit of stick about the MyCard proposal. John Wallenberg was asking you the question, and it would appear, maybe I was misreading it, that you perhaps haven't got all the information, particularly in relation to the MyCard users who don't have bank accounts.
I mean, we've made this quite clear all the way through that actually for most benefits, we don't have details on who has bank accounts and who doesn't. We ask them the best way that they want to be receiving their benefits, and for some people it's MyCard, for some people it's in their bank. We've, since the end of last year, said that the MyCard contract was coming to an end, that we weren't going to renew it, and that we wanted to try to transition as many people as possible onto using their bank accounts, but that we would look at provisions for those people for whatever reason couldn't have a bank account. And that's a whole range of different people and different individuals for different circumstances. And we're still in the process of finalising those details, but we're quite a long way on. My commitment really was to work with people, but to make sure that people know this is going to end. There's not going to be a last minute reprieve, because we're not extending the contract. We already told the company that. Actually, my cards would have to be reissued in January anyway, so everyone would have had to get a new my card, which was going to cost about £60,000 of taxpayers' money. And we think it's much better to try to transition to a more sustainable service in the long term. So the message really was very much, yes, we are working with people. We've decreased from 3,000 down to just over 1,000 people using MyCard. We think quite a few of those probably do have bank accounts but are holding out to the end. So please work with us so we can make sure that you get the benefits that you're entitled to after the end of December.
There are, though, a lot of people, possibly the more elderly people, who have used cash all their lives, and they kind of like using cash. And with the closure of many of the bank's branches across the island, their ability to get to cash in the way that they have, well, in the way that they can through the MyCard process, will be unavailable to them. How are they going to manage?
I mean, this is part of the whole access to cash question that we've been grappling with over the last couple of years, and Department for Enterprise have done a whole lot of work on that. The world is changing, and I think you're quite right that people often are used to using cash. It's not just older people. For a lot of younger people, having cash in your pocket and knowing what you can spend allows you to budget, and so access to cash is still very important. But you're quite right, we've had significant contraction of high street banks, both here and across, but also significant contraction of the post office services as well, for the same reasons, that less people are using it, to send letters, to fill out forms, to pay bills, or to take out cash. So it is that managing that transition for everyone, to make sure that people still have access to cash. And so from a Treasury perspective, we are looking at how we can ensure that, looking at the amount of ATMs that are available, how working with the banking sector to look at how they can still provide cash, mobile banking, those sort of things. But it is a reality that we have a whole new generation growing up who've probably never gone into a bank. You can even apply for your accounts online now. They do all their banking online on their phones. And so it will become inevitable that we use less and less cash, but cash is still important for lots of people for lots of different reasons, and we must provide access to that.
So I suppose then, when my card finishes, has Treasury got any plans to assist those who don't have a bank account, or indeed those who much prefer to use cash and will struggle to get access to it?
Absolutely. It's our moral responsibility, probably statutory responsibility as well. We're giving people benefits. We need to get that money to them. So we've been looking at various prepaid card systems. We've also been trying to finalise agreements with those suppliers. Again, that's difficult when they ask how many do you need, and we say we're not quite sure yet because the number's decreasing all the time. But we are working on that. We're also working to see how we could go back to checks that you cash. But again, where do you cash them if the post offices have closed down and the banks aren't available? But looking at other ways of getting cash to people, and we will have alternatives to be ready to be announced before the end of the MyCard service. What I would say is that if you're using MyCard at the moment, please reach out to Social Security now so we can help you with this transition. Because what I said during the question is, I don't want anyone to miss out around the end of the year. Christmas, New Year is always a difficult time for people financially, but it's also sometimes a difficult time to contact government services in short notice. And so please think ahead and help us help you to transition away from the current way you're receiving benefits.
A question that wasn't directly put to you, but was put to the Enterprise Minister by your colleague in Ramsey, Laurie Hooper, was in relation to when is a recession, not a recession. Mm-hmm. Now, he's looking at the GDP figures for the Isle of Man, and they would, in any normal economic parlance, indicate that the Isle of Man is in recession. Is he right?
No, I don't think he is. I mean, when you look at, and again, GDP and GNP figures for a small nation like the Isle of Man, particularly one that's predominantly, and the economy is predominantly to do with financial services, is very misleading in terms of the overall wealth and prosperity of that island. And again, what we're looking at with many of the figures are not the raw GDP or GNP, it's when you've accounted for inflation as well. And we know inflation's been incredibly high. So no, there's no evidence that the Isle of Man's in recession at all. You know, when you look at the GNP and GDP figures, they are going up step by step. There have been some issues, and we know that the pressures around the world, obviously, we're not immune to. We also know there's been some consolidation within the banking insurance sectors. We know the issues in terms of e-gaming and that people have gone to other jurisdictions with their licenses. So there are some issues there. But overall, the Isle of Man economy is remarkably resilient and healthy. What government's role really is to make sure that that prosperity is shared out equally amongst the people of the Isle of Man, which is where government policies come into their fore. It would be very easy to talk about recession, doom and gloom, and damage consumer and business confidence. And really, my job, without trying to paint a rosy picture of the whole situation, is that actually the Isle of Man is in a much better position than a lot of jurisdictions, particularly smaller jurisdictions. And we should be proud of that, not take it for granted, build on it, but also actually make sure we provide the right enablers in the local economy for people to earn a decent living, employ people, but also to make sure that wealth is shared out equally.
Do you think, though, sometimes government is so busy trying to put on a positive face and you know, trying to talk things up, which, you know, to a certain extent is part of the role of being a minister, but perhaps you lose or begin to lose credibility with the public if all they're hearing is this the kind of the positive message when that's not what people see on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, no, and I completely agree with that. And I'll be honest with you, we're going through the budget for next year, and I've had some sleepless nights trying to figure out how we balance some of the demands from education, healthcare, the constabulary, the extra things they want to do with money. Where do we get the money from? And it is getting harder. And so government finances have got remarkably more difficult over the last decade in the same way as household finances have. I think we are going through a sea change, really, catching up with some of the issues that started off in 2008 with the banking collapse, then all the other things that have affected us. And I think that the general public often ask, why is it so hard now? Why is it so hard to buy a house? Why is it so hard to afford a mortgage? Why is it so hard to make ends meet at the end of the week? Why are things so expensive? Why can't I go out more, you know, to the restaurant without spending £100 on for two people? Those sort of things. It is difficult, and I absolutely agree with that. On the other hand, I think we need to be very careful not to talk down the Isle of Man. We need to see the improvements and the benefits that we've seen. We need to appreciate our island, But I'd agree with you also, not try to gloss over some of the structural problems we have on the island. And I think, I've been quite honest about some of the issues we face in terms of particularly healthcare funding, where we get the money from, in terms of the National Insurance Scheme, the National Insurance Fund, how we make sure that's sustainable in the future. These are difficult issues to grapple and need to be taken on board, not just by politicians, but by people in our community.
That was Ramsay MHK Alex Allenson. Government asked Tynwald to receive a report about a new Child First policy. A number of children and young people attended a presentation. And here's what Anastasia and David had to say.
My name is Anastasia Schnittler and I go to St Ninian's High School.
You're here at the presentation in relation to the Child First policy. What do you know about this policy?
I mean, obviously I know a bit from my youth service. I've been shown like PowerPoints, stuff like that. And it's also been talked about. I mean, I've heard mostly about youth in youth service. I haven't heard much from school, but it's mostly just about helping children, you know, like having mental health, you know, finding places for children.
And are there things that you would think actually it would be really helpful if there was a government policy for this, or if this particular service was available to me? Are there things like that that you've noticed or thought about in your life? You thought, actually, yeah, if only government could do this, that would be much better.
I mean, I think it would be so useful, just giving kids so many more opportunities, just allowing them more freedom, more space, just so, you know, it prevents far more bad things from happening, obviously.
And in terms of the actual policy itself, I mean, have you had any opportunity to feedback into the development of the policy? I know you've been speaking with various politicians today in the Council of Ministers chamber of all places. What kind of responses have you been giving on that?
I mean, today we've just been talking about the policy. I've talked to the Minister of Education, I think, earlier, and we're just speaking about whether or not this thing would be useful, whether or not it would help children and things sort of that. But we haven't, well, I personally haven't been given any opportunity to like speak more about this, but obviously given this youth service, this whole thing is definitely a stepping stone to allow us to speak more about it. You see all the children in the council room over there. It's just insane. So many opportunities.
And so many ministers in there. I think I counted six. So that's a pretty good start.
No, definitely. Just, you know, knowing we have a voice is so impactful.
And do you think the political classes, the politicians, Tynwald members particularly, do enough to engage with young people?
I mean, I think so. Just doing this shows how much they want to help us, so much how they care and how they want our future to, you know, be better, just so we can have a voice.
Hi, I'm David Cowan, and I'm a member of the Youth Select Committee, which is the Tynwald Committee responsible for investigating issues important to the young people of our island, mainly those under 25.
So I guess you'll be delighted with the idea of putting the child first.
Absolutely. I think it's a policy that, to be honest, I'm slightly amazed it's taken this long. I think young people are the heart of any nation, really, and they should be the heart of any decision making. We should always be looking to the future and how this is going to impact our young people, because they are the future of the island.
And what do you hope that this change is going to bring about? Because there are lots of really good words, but the specifics as to what's going to be delivered presumably are still to be determined.
Yes, I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head there with the slight issues with this policy at present, in that I really hope government will take it on board and will actually implement it when making policy decisions, when looking forward to their current plans. I think that at present, this obviously isn't a statutory document. It is not binding. It still takes government to actually actively implement it, but I think done right, it could have a massively positive impact.
And at the presentation, I mean, it's very clear that most, if not all, of the ministers have turned up. It's being brought to Tynwald, so I guess that means council ministers do mean what they say in the policy document.
I hope so, yes. But like I say, I think we'll wait and see, ultimately. It is an election year, after all.
And as far as the Youth Select Committee is concerned, have you had any involvement, any direct involvement in this?
So we haven't had any direct involvement in developing the policy itself. However, our views have been sought as part of the consultation process. The team that have written the policy did come to us and ask for our views on it, ask for any input we had, and let's say our opinions on what they should be looking at when developing it.
Youth Select Committee member David Cowan there. Next, Cabinet Office Minister David Ashford.
You have a policy that is putting children first. The policy sounds great in theory, but in practice, surely government's been doing that all along. Why would government not be putting children first, particularly when it comes to areas of interest for children?
So this is one of the things that came out of the COVID review. In fact, it was recommendation 18, that we needed to look at how children's voices are actually heard. Because sometimes as adults, what we think is right for children isn't necessarily what children themselves might think is right for them. And it's important that children's voices are heard as part of that process. And that came very clearly out of the COVID inquiry. This is part of that. It's a framework to ensure that when policies are considered, when things are developed, the children's voices are actually heard. We went out, and I believe you've interviewed a couple of the children that were involved in this that have been really passionate about it. The involvement that there's been from both third sector organisations involved with children and the children themselves has been inspirational, to be honest. And now we need to put that into practice across government, ensuring that children's voices form part of policy making.
And that's the bit that's the hard bit, isn't it? It's quite easy to write policies and strategies and say the right thing. It's much more difficult when, ministers are faced with, well, okay, there are half a dozen things on the table and we can only fund two of them, to actually put the children first policy into action and pick the two that are most important to children.
Well, what's important, and we've got to be very clear about what this policy does, it doesn't mean everything suddenly gets delivered around what children may want or actually desire. It's about ensuring their voices form part of that decision-making process. So the end decision might still be exactly as it would have been otherwise, but it ensures that you've actually taken into account the needs of the child at the time that the decision is made. That's what it's about. It's not about just conceding everything and saying, we will do this, we will do that, because it's applicable to children any more than we would if it was applicable to adults. It's about ensuring that their thoughts, feelings and ideas are actually fed into that process.
So is that you say, maybe I'm just being a bit too cynical here, but is that you saying, don't worry, children, you're going to be right there, right at the centre of all our policy thinking, but there's nothing more that you're going to get out of this?
Well, it's normally me that's the cynical one, Phil, to be honest, when we do these interviews. That's not the case. I'm not saying that. What I think, actually, we will end up with much better policy as a result, because children are part of our society as well. As I said in my speech, they are the future voters, and some of those children in there today might be the future MHKs and MLCs of our island. So it is important that we are thinking about all sections of our society, and that is what this is about. It's about ensuring that's at the heart of policy making. And you're quite right in the other comment you made, Phil, that it's all very well saying this, but it's much harder when it actually comes to the doing. And that's why this has been a long time in development, and it's been important along the way that we've had buy-in from all the ministers, we've had buy-in from the chief officers as well, because ultimately we as leaders in our department need to be the ones ensuring this is embedded and being done within each of our departments.
Some of your colleagues in Tynwald pointed out that if you were serious about this, you might have had a little bit more than just a lovely policy and a nice statement, that you would be maybe putting something into law, making it much more difficult to avoid children, and making it absolutely clear that there's a legal obligation to put children first.
Well, I made absolutely clear in the debate, this is a first step. Everything has to start somewhere. This is a framework. What comes after that, you know, will be for debate in future times. But the important thing is to get this framework in place, and that's what we've actually done. There may be things in future years that Tim Wood decides, actually, we do want to go down the legislative route, or we do want to go down other routes in relation to this. But at the moment, it's about getting that framework in place and actually embedding it as culture across government.
That was Douglas North MHK, David Ashford. Next, Joni Farragher.
You moved a petition. Was this a constituency-related thing, or did you have a personal interest in this?
It wasn't a constituency issue. It was a personal interest, and the petitioners had approached me to ask if I might pick up their petition, simply because in the past I've done quite a lot of work on neurodivergence and trying to bring us in line with awareness and research. They approached me, and I was very, very happy to bring that to Tynwald Court today.
And what specifically were the petitioners looking for?
So they had actually, unusually, I suppose, for a petition, they had proposed the solution in their petition, which was that training on neurodivergence should be added to the core teacher training ongoing provision, continuous professional development. So that's the sort of inset days and the twilight sessions that teachers have. So ordinarily, when you bring a petition, you bring a motion that a select committee will be formed to look at that petition. But I was hoping to move this quicker than that, so that we could sort of cut out the evidence stage and the select committee stage, because we already had the proposed solution from the petitioners, which I very strongly agreed with and thought would really bring about some tangible change. I just liaised with the petitioners and with the Department of Education, Sport and Culture, and we did come to this agreement that we would move this particular motion. So I'm really, really happy actually for the petitioners and you know, that all of my colleagues support that today. I'm really thrilled for them.
There was a suggestion in the debate that maybe this was having a pop at some of the teachers. You were pretty firm in response to that.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely not the case. This has actually been worked up with teachers as well. Teachers have requested this. They really, really want that training. They've said many times they feel like they're under-equipped for some of the pupils in their classrooms, and they're really, really keen and on board to get this training themselves. So, there's absolutely no kind of suggestion that this is about, you know, teachers not being trained, not training themselves or not keeping up to speed. It's really, really not. This is just something about moving ourselves more in line with new awareness and new research and trying to, you know, get that training in there to support all of our children.
And for those who would say, oh, this is just one of these woke fashionable things about yet another group in society, what would you say?
Well, it's unfortunately, it's just not the case. Neurodivergence has always been around. It might have been that people were classed as a bit socially uncomfortable. It might have been that people were classed as people who couldn't control their emotions very well, or, you know, it's always been around, and our awareness of it is what's increased, and that's all there is to it.
And obviously having the training, presume anyway, helps teachers cope with those issues when they are apparent in their classes.
Yeah, that's right. And that's really the core of this motion, is that everybody wins out of this. You know, the pupils, of course, who experience neurodivergence, and the teachers who are dealing with neurodivergent pupils in their classes, and this will help their classroom practices. So I absolutely agree, by the way, with Mrs. Morfitt's contribution that it does need to be a systemic whole school approach as well. And that was the idea of it, that we start with head teachers and SENCOs, special education needs coordinators, and then we feed that, we bring that training, we bring everybody on board with that training. Because at the moment, although we had representation from members that some of the schools are doing great things, I absolutely agree with that. I know I used to work peripatetically in schools. Some schools are absolute beacons of hope in this arena, but it's a bit of a postcode lottery, and that's what we need to change.
And of course, this improves it improves the working environment for teachers, because they're better trained and better capable, but it also improves the school environment, not just for the children with neurodiversity concerns, but also all the other children, because everyone is going to be in a better place.
100%, and that's it. All of the kids will benefit from this, all the pupils, because a lot of the time at the moment, teachers time is taken up with behaviour management, and that could be offset actually by just adjusting the school environment to the physical environment, and by, you know, by better meeting the needs of neurodivergent pupils. That would mean that behaviour management requirements are reduced, which means that teachers have more time to spend on all of the other children in their class as well.
That was Douglas East MHK Joni Farragher. Finally, refreshing honesty from Tim Johnston.
Rob Collister's jaw dropped when you said in, I forget, was it an answer or certainly in the debate or an answer in Tynwald, that all the hotels were full. Rob Collister then challenged that. Who was right?
He was. It was a foot in mouth moment from me, and which I, you know, held my hand up afterwards and admitted, you know, it wasn't the right thing to say. It was in the heat of a debate, and our hotel occupancy through the summer, we do get busy, but to say that statement wasn't right. So I wrote to members after that sitting and apologised and said that I would be making a personal statement to the next sitting at Tynwald, which is obviously today. So, that's where it stands. So I'll be making it's quite right today that I make a personal statement to record in Hansard in the court that what I said was wrong, and that's what I'll be doing today.
That was Tim Johnston, MHK. So what do you think? Is the Manx economy in recession? I suppose ministers are right to keep talking things up, but should they be a little more open about the difficulties many of us are facing? Was Tynwald right to back the call for neurodiversity training? Will it help reduce some of the behavioural difficulties being faced across Manx schools? And do you think the government's Child First policy will make a difference? Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast on Manx Radio's website. I'm Phil Gawne. Goramayos an geisteachrom. Thanks for listening.